This is the second half of an interview with John Miller for the Cultural Icons Project. And today, John, I'd like to start by asking you a bit about a key figure in your life. I think she's an anthropologist, Joan Metger.
Yes, Joan and I have known each other for 44 years. We met 44 years ago when she and Gilbert Boyd of the Māori Education Foundation came out to the Ipuni Boys Home and rescued me from a life of working in car factories in the Hutt Valley, where I had been sent.
How old were you then?
16 and a half.
Right.
So I'd got quite a good pass in school C, but because of family circumstances and my mother being in hospital, I was scooted down to Wellington and ended up in this situation. But anyway, I remember Joan coming along, and she at that time was a reader in anthropology at Victoria University. I think the professor there at the time, the founding professor of anthropology there, was a Professor Jan Power, and she put me back to school at Wellington College, and I shared a large bedroom with a first-year university student called Clive Cullen from Hawera, who was doing his architecture intermediate.
And, did she just sort of walk in off the street to see
found out I was in I think the Māori Education Foundation found out about me being down in Wellington,
right.
And Joan somehow was involved, and anyway, the two of them came out. And,
had she known your mother before?
No, it was
just
totally,
right off the cuff.
But that's Joan. She's such a wonderful, warm, caring, loving person. I'm not the only person that she's sort of whangaed in this way. but I was most fortunate that she took me under her wing when I was sort of quite vulnerable time, sort of mother having been hospitalised and. Went back to Wellington College, which was a rather different cultural experience from attending two previous co-ed secondary schools in the upper part of the North Island. So I lived in this large two-storied house in Glen Road, which belonged to a gentleman called Marcus King, who was a painter, actually. There was a big landscape of his that was in the house, and at first I stayed in the downstairs billiard room, and then I went upstairs, and I met a very interesting group of people who came and went and through that house. I met the very young Paul Reeves, now former Governor General. He visited once. I met the Australian Aboriginal Land Rights activist Charles Perkins, who visited. Either before or after he did his bus trip through Queensland, trying to liberate the swimming pools, so for 2 years I stayed with Joan in that particular residence, and then another one up.
That was also her house, or
no? She rented it off Marcus King.
She rented it off.
Yeah, and then she had another. Then the following year she moved up to Upland Road and had a place above Barbara Basham, who was Auntie Daisy's daughter. You know, Daisy Basham on the radio talk
Aunt
show.
Aunt Daisy?
Yeah. So I knew Aunt Daisy's... Barbara was the previous tenant of the space, and there was a lady downstairs who was there. So, we took over the space from Barbara. And just along the road from us was the pro-Chancellor of Victoria University, George Culliford, who during the Second World War got the highest Polish decoration, the Virtuti Militari, for flying a Dakota transport aircraft across German-occupied Europe. for the Polish partisans to load pieces of a V-2 rocket into his Dakota for him to fly it back to the Allies for them to examine this this piece of German technology. So anyway, George was just along the road, and he recounted this tale of flying this Dakota into this airfield with a battery of German 88mm anti-aircraft flak guns parked up just a wee way over at some chateau. So they sort of sneaked in under the nose of fairly heavy German armaments to get this thing out. So anyway, these are all the sort of people I was coming across. And I was there for 2 years, and then I went to university, boarded at Weir House.
Joan, was she already very much focused on her writings and researches into things Maori?
Yeah, she. Yeah. This is late 67. Well, the previous decade, of course, she had done her studies of studying Maori migration to the cities in Auckland and Ahipara up north, and she stayed with the Nathan family, Bella Nathan and her folks up in Ahipara, and did her fieldwork and did her studies that for the book that she wrote. So she did this. She was studying this whole phenomenon of Maori moving to the cities in search of work, and what that the implications of that with the population sort of moving from the tribal homelands and living in the cities. And in a rather odd quirk of fate, her first Maori informants lived up the near her family home in Sudley Street in Orakei, Bella Taua and her husband. And strangely enough, my daughter ended up, a great-grandson of this couple ended up going out with my daughter for about a year recently. That was sort of just an intriguing little sort of connection.
That's our 2 degrees of separation.
Yeah, that's
in New Zealand, isn't it?
Yeah. So Jane was quite surprised to find that to learn that this young man was this great grandson of her very close Maori friends, and then subsequent to that, she'd written a book called Maoris of New Zealand. Which she then republished when I lived with her for a second period in the mid-70s. She republished it, this book here, The Maoris of New Zealand, Rautahi, for which she used my photographs. So I illustrated this book here.
Right. Now, is that a recent reprint of that
book?
No,
this is an original. This is an original copy published in 1970. It was first published in 1967 and revised in 76, and so there was various. That's a photograph I took of the New Zealand Maori Council meeting in Parliament in 1974 or 5, she used all my photographs in this. And by that stage, she was living up in Paisley Terrace in Karori. And at the same time, Michael King was around, and he got me to supply photographs for this book here, Te Ao Huruhuri. So there's a set of my photos in this. And these two books were being put through at the same time.
Right.
Then again, the last time I stayed with Joan was in 1988 when I had a stint working at Television New Zealand in Wellington. And then in the early 90s, after her father passed away, she decided to move to live in Auckland to be closer with family and her social network up here. Joan I see quite a lot, actually. My daughter Rediata and I went out to have dinner with her a couple of nights ago, and gave her our belated birthday wishes. She's 81, her 81st birthday, last Tuesday, of February of this year. And the last book that she's put out, Tuamaka, set of essays on difference in New Aotearoa. She's used a set of photographs I took during the Hands Across the Beach demonstration at Ahipara at the beginning of 2004. Yes. It was the start of the big campaigns against the first foreshore and seabed the bill that the then Labor government was pushing through. And there is a photo, there is a photograph I took of Joan that's in this book when she was at that. And Joan is, she actually retired from the Anthro department in 1988, and she's been sort of kept a cracking pace ever since, writing papers and still publishing. And recently, for time, she was on the Waitangi National Trust, which she's just relinquished that position now, and she gives, still does work at the university and gives lectures, and so she's still very busy writing, and she's a real treasure to the country.
And would you say that her making contact with you at that time was a key factor in focusing your consequent camera lens on the subjects it's been focused on?
In May of 1967, she and Bernie Curnott, who was one of her colleagues in the Anthro department, took me up to the opening of the Pare Waha Waha meeting house in Balls, and I had my little plastic Russian twin lens reflex camera. So that hui that she took me to was the first time that I photographed a Māori event, and so she sort of... I had been to hui before. In 1963, I went to the coronation in Ngarawahi. Of course, it was King Koroki in those days. I remember being there as a young sort of intermediate school person, I think, at that stage. So I'd been to hui before. I'd been to up home. But that was the first one I photographed. And and of course, you had various... contacts in the Māori world who I came across, as well as Sir Paul Reeves, or just Paul Reeves as he then was, coming to visit her in Kelburn. One of the Anglican ministers, Pura Panapa, visited and stayed at the house. actually, I went to bed. He was sharing our bedroom, and I was put on a folding bed, and I went to bed early, and then Pura comes in and he goes to sleep, and I get woken up by his snoring, and I couldn't get back to sleep, so I folded the bed up and wheeled it out the door onto the landing to go to sleep on the landing. And Joan came out and said, "Oh, what's going on? I can't sleep, he's snoring too loudly." So I ended up, she said, "Oh, well, you better wheel your bed in here." So I ended up wheeling the bed into her bedroom and sleeping down the corner of her bedroom. So all these interesting people who I got to know because of her. So
And did she come to know your mother?
Yes, she knew Mum. Yes, she knew Sarah. Yeah, and when my mum passed away, and when my mother was in her final illness at the end of latter part of 2009, Joan was an incredible tower of strength, helping us and sort of getting us going through that. And when Mum passed away, she was really, really. So supportive during that fairly difficult time.
And your mother, if we could trace back again to the time, of course, before you met Joan, your mother had been an Elam student, hadn't she?
Yeah, she went to Elam when she was about 16. And wait a minute. She was still 16 when she went to Elam in 1943 during the war. And Auntie Charlotte, who is going to be 90 next October, my surviving auntie on this side of the family, she recalls that I think the principal sent some drawings of Mum's down to Elam, and they sort of signed her up, and so she. And,
so she was still a school pupil at that stage.
Yeah.
Was she up?
But that was typical. That was typical of Elam students. Elam students were a lot younger then than they are now. And anyway, Mum turns up at Elam in her gym frock, her school gym frock, and apparently got quite teased quite mercilessly about her sort of garb, which sort of
She had been at What up at
Okaihau? Yeah, I think she was in standard. She got as far as about standard six. Then she went straight to Elam from standard six, which is whatever standard six is in the new language. So she was at Elam for 18 months, and apparently Charlotte also told me that she had so much promise that the Elam staff wanted her to go travelling around the schools showing the school students, you know, art and talking to art to them about art to them and showing, demonstrating her work. But she didn't have the confidence. She was too shy. Yes. Didn't have the confidence, and that's really sad, because if she had the confidence, she may well have continued on, and she could have beaten Arnold Wilson as the first Māori person to get a diploma out of Elam.
She didn't graduate.
No, she left before, which was quite, this happened quite a bit. I was talking to the young installation artist Bridie Rood, who I've got to know recently. Her grandmother, Elsa Stevenson, no, Elsa Williamson. I think it's Elsa Williamson. She was at Elam at exactly the same time as my mum, and she said that her grandmother sort of left early to sort of have families and things. So it was one of those things that happened. mum left Elam and went back to the farm, and I think it was when her brother got killed, after her brother got killed in the war.
One of your uncles?
Yeah.
Was he in the
Māori? He was in the Air Force. He actually crashed his Kitty Hawk at Ohakia in February of 45 during low-level target practice. And he was only 21, and that really shocked her quite badly, because she was very close to Wilson. When Mum, in about 3 or 4 days before Mum passed away on November the 5th, I said to Mum, "Oh, Mum, it's Wilson's birthday today." And she says, "Oh, happy birthday, Wilson," in the little tiny voice. And she didn't continue her studies, but her art studies, but she was her artistic flair did manifest itself in other ways later on, when she and my father met a few years after that, but the marriage wasn't all that very happy, and but unlike a lot of women who suffered through incompatible bad marriages, she didn't put up with this, and she actually left my dad, took me, enrolled herself in a pressure cooker course in Section T at Epsom Teachers Training College in 1956, and we lived in a little boarding house in Scotia Place. We went out to the tram island outside Myers Park and caught the tram out to Mount Eden. So I'm probably one of the last of a generation who can remember travelling on trams around Auckland. And so we'd catch the tram to Auckland, the Teachers Training College, I remember I went to a little school out the back called Model Country, which was acted as a training sort of ground.
Is that what they now call, or used to call, the normal school?
No. It's called, I think it's called Cohere School now or something, but it was called Model Country, and we were allowed to wear jeans and climb trees. So I was there for a little while, but Mum couldn't afford to keep me on her £4 a week stipend. This is in the days when they actually did pay you to go to training college to learn to be a teacher, but £4 a week wasn't enough for two of us, so she sent me up north to my Uncle Graham. So I got packed off onto a DC-3 with curtains on the windows and a string bag containers on the back of the seats, which droned its way very noisily up to Kaikohe. Where I ended up staying with uncle and auntie at the family farm.
At Okaihau?
Yeah.
Right.
And until Mum finished off her training course in August or September of 57.
And was she training as an art teacher?
No, she was just teaching general, you know, this was primary school.
Right.
I've still got her workbook. I've still got her workbook, which is embellished with these beautiful watercolour drawings and calligraphy, sort of the old English calligraphy, because they used to do calligraphy at art school. So the art school side of her training comes through in the way she decorated her workbook from training college. I remember she did have some. She did do some watercolours of the harbour, looking from the North Shore over to Rangitoto, but those have been lost. And in very recent years, jumping forward a bit, in recent years when she was at the rest home in Herne Bay, she would go quite regularly to Quentin and Kathy Whitehouse's. This is Davina Whitehouse's son.
Yes.
Quentin and Kathy Whitehouse, who then ran Western Pottery Supplies in Linwood Avenue over in Mount Albert, and do pottery painting. So she churned out about 70, either cup and saucer combinations or mugs, and you and Hilary have got two of those yourself.
Yes, we're the fortunate recipients. Yeah.
And so she did these marvellous little sort of floral flowers on these cups and saucers or mugs. I've got a dark blue mug with a lovely hibiscus on it, and my landlord's got a little short black coffee cup with a peach blossom on it, and so her legacy, her art legacy, is sort of scattered around people's kitchens in these in this crockery.
Now I remember her Elam period paintings and drawings. They're very they're very graphic, and they're very much in the social realist sort of almost romantic tradition of Lois White. Was she taught by Lois White?
Yes, she was. She was taught by Lois White, and actually this is quite amazing. I about 3 weeks before she passed away, I thought, well, I'll just see, you know, how she is mentally, you know. I sort of bent over and said, "Oh, Mum, can you remember who your Elam lecturers were?" And she says, "Oh, Archie Fisher, Mona Malcolm, Lois White." She rattled off about two or three other names. So from the point of view of her memory was pretty good, sort of being able to rattle off her Elam lecturers sort of from 1943. The reason why you are able to describe her artwork is that in the early 80s, one of the members of my uncle's household was looking around in the ceiling of the old family homestead and found this big folder containing her Elam work portfolio that had been sitting up there for about the last 40 years. Which had been put up, in the ceiling, probably after she came back from Elam, and been forgotten about. And so it was like this little visual time capsule.
Amazing.
So we had all the calligraphy and the still lifes and the architecture studies, and they'd go round Auckland, sitting on their little triangular, their little sort of folding camp stools, drawing various buildings around Auckland. So the St. Matthew's, the church up at the top of Wellesley Street and Simon Street, can't remember that name, and the Partington's Mill. They'd go and draw Partington's Mill, which is now on the site of the Langham, unfortunately they had life study drawing at Elam, but only one of those photographs of one of those drawings have survived, because she had an attack of shyness apparently not long after she left Elam, and she burnt all her life studies except the one that still survives, because it was on the back of a painting. And she also did this very fine watercolour of this woman, this very sort of long leggy woman with all sorts of sea symbols around her, which is very reminiscent of the Lois White style.
Yes.
There are two particular paintings of Lois White's which she echoes.
At that time at Elam with Archie Fisher,
she said that Archie didn't actually take many. He was only did a little. Mm. He did. He just did a little bit of teaching at that stage.
He was insistent on drawing.
Mm.
That much I remember from having studied Fairbairn and his relationship.
Well, Mum's drawings, you look at her drawings, she has a great control of shade and light.
Yes.
And sort of, yeah, it's, we're very fortunate to have them. And I think they're having a big exhibition in the next year or two to commemorate the founding of Elam.
Mm.
And I think Jonathan Mane Fiorke wants to feature some of these some of this work in that exhibition of that.
Now, this is always a very hard thing to define, and your mother's activities as an art student predate your birth, but it certainly is a strong possibility, if such things can be inherited, that you inherited her eye.
Yeah, well, actually, I got it from both directions, because although he didn't tell me much about this at the time, my dad went to Elam in the late 30s part-time. So I'm a product of two Elam students.
Right, and did he stay there long?
No. I don't know how long he stayed, but with this concentration of Elam on calligraphy, Dad actually, his profession was a sign writer. He was a sign writer, and he spent the whole of his career working at the Kauri Point Naval Base, doing signs, and he'd also do murals and things, and so he was artistic.
So that accounts for both eyes, doesn't
it? Yeah.
So one from one parent, one from the other.
Yeah.
Was your mother happy at the direction your activities took as you moved more and more into photography? And
well, I think she just accepted that was I was doing my thing. I was at university, and I sort of. I started off, I actually started photographing when I was quite young, just sort of snapshot type photographs. Then in secondary school period, I was photographing. I photographed, as I mentioned in our first part, I photographed my first Vietnam demonstration before I went down to Wellington and met Joan. I did the Marshall Key demonstration. I sort of ended up, well, there was a lot going on in Wellington during that time with the anti-war protests and the anti-tour protests, and then of course photographing the Ngā Tama Tour era. I just sort of ended up sliding off into just doing this photography thing.
To go back then to your family background, and documentary photography. Your mother was part of a very big family, many siblings, and it was a rural farming Māori family. To what extent were they actively aware of the whole issue of the loss of Māori culture and the loss of land? Did they have an implicit awareness of it? Was it spoken of openly, or was it a kind of implicit thing, or was it not spoken of?
My mother's father was the son of an English immigrant who arrived in this country in 1861. On the Black Eagle, and my Miller great grandfather arrived on Joseph Craig in 1859. My grandfather Bill Alexander married my grandmother Harata Ramaka, so we have a bicultural side. But the Māori side of the family was lost because my grandmother died in 1935, so only Annie, my older sisters Annie and aunties Annie and Charlotte, could understand Māori, and the younger members of the family lost the Māori side.
Did your mum understand Māori?
No, she's too young. My mother's only nine when my grandmother died.
So she's younger than Charlotte, is
she? Yes. Charlotte, yes, I said Charlotte's 90 later this year. She was aware of her Māori side, but she wasn't sort of so involved in marae activities, but she was very proud of it, as were my uncles and other aunties. one of my uncles, of course, the one who fostered me for a year while Mum was at training college, Graham, sort of couple down from her and the family, he was very much involved in the forestry issue.
I remember Graham coming to the house. And he also had a bulldozer.
Oh, I can't remember that.
I can remember talking with him. Oh, okay. He had earth moving machinery.
Anyway, Graham and Melda, my auntie Melda, who's still alive, and they also had a very big family. they took over the family farm that my great grandfather founded in the late 1860s in the Waiho Valley north of Waikaihau, and which was where I stayed when I was six. And Graham got himself embroiled in a very complicated Māori land dispute over 14,000 acres of land west of Kawakawa, where he was a trustee of a trust appointed to put this into forestry. And he found himself getting back involved in that side of things through that involvement, where he refused to go along with this with a one-track approach of leasing it to one particular forestry company for 99 years, and he wanted it to go to open tender, and got embroiled in a terribly complex series of court cases and what so forth.
At what stage did he become involved in that?
He was involved in, I remember him being involved in 1973, which is when I first found out about it.
Right.
But he wasn't appointed as trustee until about 1974.
That land is distinct from the block that you were later particularly focused on.
No, this is the same one.
It's the same block.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Ngāti Hine block here.
I have to say it's
the Ngāti Hine block because it is primarily located in the area of the Ngāti Hine sub-tribe, which is the tribe of Kawiti and Sir James Henare and other prominent people. But our home area is to the north, Waimate North, around Ngāi Te Waka Kiuta. And the reason we're involved is we had a small shareholding in a block on the contiguous boundary between our area and their area. So my uncle was involved. He got pulled in on it to be a member of the trust and kept getting chucked off it when he wouldn't sign this lease. So we ended up, when he was put back on the trust and ordered to sign the lease by the Māori Appellate Court, we actually just managed to mobilise the shareholders to form action committees to frustrate this particular move. And we ended up, this was taking place concurrently with such disputes as Bastion Point and the Raglan Golf Course dispute, which were getting quite big publicity. And our issue, which was a bit more esoteric and complicated and quite difficult to present to the populace. So I ended up carrying out the task of a general gopher and feature and carry and doing press releases and organising people to meetings. And
is that how I first met you? Because I was involved in the issue from another angle.
Yeah, you were involved with the forestry
director
angle.
Director of Friends of the Earth.
Yeah. So this being about 1977, so there's all sorts of, there's a whole nexus of situations happening here with the forestry issues and the Māori land issues, the Bastion Point and whatnot. And so I ended up being the secretary of this action committee, and I was associating with the various elders of the tribal group, like the late Dick Kakea, captain in the Māori battalion, who fought under Sir James Henare, who was colonel, a whole various group of people. And sadly, nearly all of them have passed away now. I think Mari Tautari, who's Winston Peters' sister, was involved because she was married to one of the shareholders, Mange Tautari. So she was involved quite strongly in the committee, and she's one of the last survivors of this period. And so I was involved in this. I did a bit of photography of it.
Yes.
I did photograph some of the activities of meetings and the land and so forth. And I was keeping all the newspaper clippings. The Auckland University Student Association gave us a donation of $300 for a lawyer, which is probably worth about $3,000 these days, and $200 of services. So we were sending out notices and using the Xerox machine to send out information to the shareholders.
So it was very much a documentary exercise, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was. But unlike most situations where I was on the outside just photographing someone else's process, I was actually right in the middle of the activity. I was a participant and photographing from being inside, which is quite an interesting situation. But we people gave us very little chance, you know, say, oh, you'll never win this, you know. The Maori Appellate Court sort of ordering this to happen, and no one gave us a show. But we actually took them to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that the Maori Appellate Court was out of order, changing trust orders to order trustees to do specific things. They were trying to set up a particularly serious precedent, because trustees are supposed to have discretion to do what they are appointed to do what they wish. They are not supposed to be directed to do one course of action regardless of their conscience. And so we managed to beat that back, and the situation resolved. The standoff was resolved with a change of, with the Supreme Court ruling sort of squashing the appellate court. Quite interestingly enough, the Sir Eddie Dury was a member of that panel.
Does that decision still stand?
What, the Mann decision?
The Supreme Court decision.
Well, it wasn't challenged. So that was a precedent. I think this case is it's known in the law reports as Alexander and others versus the Māori Appellate Court and others. That's the short name of it. So we went back to square one, and there were some changes of personnel in the Māori Affairs Department. Ken Hingston came in as Chick McHugh. Chick McHugh came in as the new Land Court judge. Tom Parore took over from Bryce Henry as the district officer, and a new sort of formulation of trustees was set up, with him being the principal trustee, and a group of forestry companies renegotiated the whole deal, and we ended up having a 33-year deal with much improved terms. And so the forestry scheme got underway in 1981, so I photographed that. I was back there in November 1985, photographing a visit of Auckland University with Colin Maiden and Lindo Ferguson in the Māori Studies Department, visiting Matawaia Marae to thank the Ngāti Hene people for the timber that is used for the carvings for Waipapa, Tāne Nui Arangi, the Māori meeting house at the Auckland University of Marae. So the Auckland University of Marae has the timber from our land on that.
It's a really interesting outcome, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's a circle thing. You know, the Auckland Student Association give us money to help fight the legal case, and we win the legal case, and then the timber goes to the Marae, and the university comes to thank us. So it's quite an interesting sort of.
Well, am I right in saying
the president of the Students Association in 1976, when we got the donation, was Dr. Michael Walker, who's the son of Dr. Rangi Walker.
Right.
Mm.
Well, am I right in summarising the issue of that time with the forestry issue of that time with Māori land as being one of the danger posed by trust boards making agreements with big and often multinational forestry companies that were going to last for 99 years and therefore going to effectively alienate that land and result also in bad land use practices?
This particular case wasn't unique. the Te Hauhua 42 case was on at the same time up north, where a pulp company was trying to get hold of a bit of swap lease land, and I actually was involved in helping to frustrate that when one of the incorporation members let slip to me inadvertently at a function at Auckland University that they were going to be signing this lease. And of course the folks involved at Te Hauhua 42 were campaigning very strongly against it, and so I sort of quickly rang up Sana Murray, the very well-known land rights campaigner for many years from Ngāti Kuri, who's, I think she's still alive too. She's one of the last sort of survivors of the Māori Land March. And Sana and her folks, she got her lawyer to put it to injunct the incorporation in the Lands and Survey Department and to frustrate this cross lease. So that, and we got a front page Herald out of that because I was pushing out the press releases for them, and they had a big meeting the following year, and all the shareholders met to vote that proposal down. Other parts of the country have extensive privately planted forests on leased land around the place, and but I don't know what's happened as a result in recent times, but it is a problem where you have 99-year leases where the management of the land gets divorced from the actual ownership because of this these artificial decision-making structures that are erected because of the confusion and dispersal of the Māori landowners because of this ridiculous system of individualised shares, which when this was happening, when this happened to me in 1976, I didn't know what the heck I'd struck because I hadn't studied it at school, didn't know anything about it. I didn't know what the Māori land... I thought the Māori Land Court was a bit like a court where it dealt with concepts like justice. The Māori Land Court dealt with concepts like pragmatic land utilisation. And as far as it was concerned, in 1974, we were a bunch of malcontents frustrating proper production and utilising land for the best interests of the economy. And so we had to be put down, you know, we had to be dealt with. We were able to raise the question, well, you know, there is sort of a matter of property rights and inherent matters of justice here. And so I had to sort of do a bit of fast research, working out where the Māori Land Court came from. And, you know, the 1865 legislation setting up the Native Land Court was very pragmatic in its tension of the function of the court being to purge the Māori of its the beastly communism of the Māori and enable the Māori estate to be acquired for settlement. So the Māori Land Court in the 70s was the heir and successor to an attitude of mind which came from colonialist exploitation and defeasing the Māori of their communal lands and turning it into a form that was able to be chipped away at piecemeal, and also gave rise to a similar situation at Bastion Point, where Ngāti Whātua lost their estates in Auckland gradually through the 10 ownership rule, where the 10 owners were the ones who had all the say, and the land was sold over the heads of the people, and. I think this is an argument that will have to be resolved about whether Māori land should return to communal ownership and do away with this nonsense of having individualised shares. It's an argument that still hasn't really happened yet, but other people are starting to float it. I actually mentioned that this should be done in my 1979 submissions to the Commission of Inquiry into the Māori Land Court. But I just want to go on.
Wasn't it through this that you met Darcy Lang?
That's correct, yeah.
Yes.
Darcy, I actually... first of all, Julian Rosenberg rang me up in early August of 1977 saying, oh, there's this guy come back from Europe and he's a video maker, you should meet him. And then not long after that, I saw Darcy on Kaleidoscope playing the flamenco guitar, which he was very good at. Then later in August, I was on the phone to him, doing some project, and Darcy at that stage had come back from doing his work studies in England. He was an Elam student. He was an Elam student himself, who then went to the Royal College. He started off being a sculptor, then moved into video. He was one of the very first video pioneers using reel-to-reel black and white videotape, and he did these sort of long tape work studies of schools and workers doing things. He set the camera going and just he'd film a process. And Darcy turned up. He acquired some low-band Sony U-matic equipment from Ian McDonald, who was exhibition officer at the Auckland City Gallery, and he went down to Ngāti Porou and did some work, some school studies at one of the primary schools, Hiru Harama Primary School, with David Goldsmith, the headmaster there. Then he linked up somehow with Joe and folks at Bastion Point, and he actually produced probably the only in-depth video study of the life at Bastion Point in the latter part of 1977, just after that very boggy winter. And so in the National Film Archives, I've got his holdings. I think the Darcy Langey estate have lodged his archive down at the film archives. And I met him around that time. And so while I was involved in this forestry campaign with the Land Court, we actually did a bit of videoing of that as well. So we videoed a owners meeting at Ōtara, and a court case, one of the court cases at Kawakawa, and we did a bit of interview of one of the members of the action committee at the Matawaia Marae. So we've got some video of this particular struggle as well as the photographs. So we've got a pretty good documentation of it. And actually, one of the people I think that's in the video is one of our very strong supporters of this forestry case, as well as the stalwarts of Bastion Point, Machu Tarawa, who very sadly has passed away in the last 24 hours. And so I just want to remember Machu, a very staunch, fiery character, who was, if you look at the photographs of the day 507 of the eviction, you can see him figure in the photos in the porch with the others in the porch of Arohanui. So Machu's fought his last fight, but he was quite a hard case, Machu. I remember him telling me with great relish how he comes from Tauranga, Ngāti Ranginui, and he was chased. He chased some Ministry of Works people off some of his family land by thrusting out this wooden box and saying, "I've got some jellicnite in this, and if you people don't take off, I'm going to blow you up." he was pretty direct. Machu was one of those who we've got film of.
Machu used to perform right towards the end of his life with Darcy.
He sang. He would start off Darcy's flamenco guitar and poetry reading concerts at the concert chamber that you yourself had some role in yourself. He used to sing that Italian one. I can't remember what it's called.
No, I can't remember his name now, but he always prefaced the concert with it. Yeah.
So that was Darcy. Actually, Darcy passed away very tragically, as we both know, in about July of 2005, but fortunately for him, the present curator of the Govett Brewster Gallery, Mercedes Vicente, had just turned up in New Zealand with her partner Peter Waring, her Kiwi boyfriend Peter Waring. She's from Barcelona, but she'd been in the art world in New York for about 20 years. And when her friends learnt that she was coming to New Zealand, they said, "Oh, you've got to meet Darcy Langey." And she got about 3 weeks before she got here, Darcy died, so she never actually got to meet him. But Mercedes has virtually been the one who has brought to life Darcy's artistic legacy, and this is this big catalogue, the Darcy Lange yes. catalogue that Dr. Geraldine Peters and I contributed to Chapter 2. And he had a big show, a retrospective posthumous show at the Govett Brewster in 2006, which has also been, parts of it have been shown in New York and Austria. And I think this is a little brochure that the Austrians put out on Darcy's exhibition in Graz. And
Darcy, the question of making films rises again. And you have been directly involved in the making of quite a few films.
Well, I've been involved in taking stills photography of two of Barry Barclay's films, Nati, February, March 1986, and Feathers of Peace, that he filmed along the style of Peter, what's the name of that? Peter Watkins. Mm. Very similar to Peter Watkins' Culloden, actually. Mm. That sort of genre.
It was almost a deliberately documentary style, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so I did the stills for that, and it's the only time that my stills have actually been cut into the film. So Barry was actually directing me to get particular angles of sequences of photos that would go into the cut into the film. And after we finished, I was expecting that I would have had to have produced these very large prints or get them scanned high resolution. But it was quite funny. The camera operator ended up sort of doing these rostrum camera shots of these 6 inch by 4 inch machine prints. And it was quite strange seeing these blown up into a gigantic size in the Civic Theatre. So there's that aspect of doing film stills, and also I did quite a few film stills with for Māori drama series that Larry Parr produced in 1989, and later the late Don Salwin did a series of Māori drama in the early 2000s that I did film stills for as well. Actually, it might have been earlier than that. I did the film stills for Māori Merchant of Venice.
Who was the producer of that?
I think it was Don.
Don Selwyn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I was involved in co-producing and doing a little bit of camera work on a little documentary in 1986-87 of the journey of the. Of our ancestral canoe Ngā Tuki Matawhaurua from Waitangi up to Whangaroa Harbour. I did that with John Spurdle and Tainui Stevens, very prominent Māori film director and producer these days. We borrowed him from TVNZ, and he directed our little, nice little documentary that we did. It was actually the first half hour production that he directed. He was working on a sort of some magazine program on TVNZ, which was where he'd do these quarter hour ones. So that's the actual only one that I've actually co-produced.
Right.
Just a one-off. But I've had this other, and also I've done camera operating work for Alistair Barry and Rod Prosser of Vanguard Films Andrea Bossard. A little production that she did a while back, so I do both.
And working with Barry Barclay, how did you find that?
Oh, that was very interesting, actually. It was good. Barry was good to work with, and
I personally think he's one of the best filmmakers we've ever had.
Yeah, no, Nati was really interesting. It was the first Māori. Directed production, and had a big Māori crew in it. Quite a few of the crew had been at his film course the previous year at the Hawke's Bay Community College. Because when he Where he did he did the landmark series Tangata Whenua series in, with Michael King in 1974. Then he went to England. He went overseas, and then he came back around. Overseas he did the very prescient film Neglected Miracle on the control of seed stocks by big companies.
Yes.
Sort of, you know, presaging the whole
genetic engineering racket.
Yeah. And he came back to New Zealand, and he knew that there were very few Māori involved in the production process of documentaries. Now, he was working with Pākehā crew all the time. And he thought, well, by the time he came back here in the early 80s, that surely to goodness there's going to be Māori people involved all through the industry. He was quite shocked to discover there weren't. So he managed to wangle the Labour Department into sort of setting up this little scheme at the Hawke's Bay Community College. And he had a number of local Māori, and there were some Pākehā, because the Labour Department insisted that it be sort of by a multicultural effort. So anyway, he had a group of Māori and some Pākehā folks as well in this film production course, and so he ran around sort of the Hawke's Bay with a bowl with a Ariflex BL filming little exercises, and we went and filmed David Long. He visited a press conference in Haepia, and we interviewed Canon Wehuata from the Māori Battalion, and I took some stills, I took some photographs of that, and we stayed with Barry was with Anne, with the actress Anne Budd at the time, so we stayed up at Hospital Hill. We stayed up at Hospital Hill with Anne's parents in their big two-storied house, which was the first time I actually came across Halloween.
Halloween?
Yes, the first time I ever saw it. I saw this bizarre American import,
yes,
custom of children going around the streets importuning unhealthy food.
Had it arrived here as a result of American television?
I can tell you, the film E.T.
That's what brought
had
it
just
here.
Been shown, and E.T. Had a big passage about Halloween in it in 1985, and all of a sudden, 1985 was when Halloween burst on the country.
3 minutes.
Yeah.
To go back to Barry Barclay and Feathers of Peace, that film seemed to me to combine two things. One, the powers of a documentary still camera, and the other, the powers of documentary film, plus, of course, being a narrative film in its own right. Which brings me to the question, you've worked in both fields, stills and film. Do you think that photography is more your central
métier? I've been doing it for such a long time. I've sort of just got used to being, you know, photography. You're just a crew of one. You know,
yes.
With the movie making, that you need to be need to be a group of people, although
yes,
with the very small cameras you get these days, you are able to be a one-man band a bit better, but I just seem to have sort of ended up in the stills, although I do have to say that I've just recently got into the digital platform, which is quite ironic after the item that the Māori Television Arts Programme did on me a year ago, where I was still singing the praises and purity of the film platform, which I still agree with. But it's really fascinating with digital. Having a digital camera, you can do totally different things. And I've discovered that you're not limited with just having 10 photos or 36 photos. You can shoot huge sequences, and you can use digital cameras totally differently from film cameras. In that one technique I've hit upon is setting up the camera on a tripod and aiming at some sort of activity, whether it's an art opening, someone doing some artwork, or people preparing food in the kitchen, and just have the camera sitting on a tripod and tapping the shutter, and you build up a sequence of movement within the image.
Mm.
Where, and then you can project it back, either you put it into a preview on Mac or iMovie, and you actually sort of get a sort of a film.
It's a semi-movie.
Yeah, it is.
And in a way, it reminds me a little bit of what Darcy was doing all those years ago in Spain.
Yeah. And I've got this compact little. I should have got it out of my bag. This compact little camera is about. Mm. It's not much bigger than a cigarette packet. It's very unobtrusive. It shoots raw files, so I can do good quality, you know, blow-ups on it as well. And so you can do this totally different work. The AUT had a Art After Dark exhibition at Western Park last year, and I did about three coverages of some of the artwork where I was tapping the shutter and getting these artworks that change colour and do things. And so because the frame stays the same, it looks like a movie. And so this is really interesting to explore these different directions.
Well, it looks like, in a way, you can go into the future with still both eyes open and new possibilities.
Yeah.